We are in Galatians chapter 4, and we have been looking at the last paragraph in the section. Major section of the book, chapters 3 and 4. This is the last paragraph in that major section. And we've already said Paul decided at this point to go to a historical analogy in order to try to make the point that he's been making as clear as he can. Chapters 3 and 4 have gone through the whole argument about why promise and law are different entities and the superiority of promise because of the things it accomplishes and the methodology that's involved in all that. He's gone through a detailed presentation of all of that, but apparently feels like in verses 21 through the end of the paragraph that maybe the Galatians haven't really gotten the idea yet. So he just addresses them in verse 21 with this question, "You who want to be under the law, don't you hear? Don't you listen?" In other words, the law has a message. It's a critical message. If you understand the message of the law, there's no way under the sun that you'd want to be under it. If you understand what the law does, what its message is, there's no way that you'd want to be under the law. That's the rationale for the question. Of course, he's already told us back there in chapter 3 that you're under a curse if you're under the law. Nobody would want to be there. But nonetheless, he apparently feels like they aren't really picking it up, or maybe they won't. I mean, he's writing. He doesn't know how they're going to react, but anyway, last time in our study, we looked into verse 22 as the introduction to the message that they're not listening to or aren't hearing. And our argument last time was the fact that, well, several points, but the fact that historical narrative is a way of revealing the theological reality. True theology will always show up in real history because truth works. So all of this theological stuff in the chapter has a historical illustration. And it consists of the story in Genesis about Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and the issues of the birth of Ishmael and Isaac. So he says in verse 22, it's written, Abraham had two sons. And he never mentions the name of this son at this point. He does mention Hagar's name in verse 25, and he doesn't mention Sarah by name, I guess. I was looking at that to see. He doesn't mention Isaac by name or Ishmael by name, which helps us understand what his point is, because it's clear from verse 22 that Abraham's two sons constitute a historical narrative that will illustrate the message of the law, if we're willing to hear it. And the issue is that one of the sons was born of a bondwoman, a woman who was in bondage. She was the handmaid of the wife in the family. And the other one was the wife, the free woman. And in our study, we talked about how bondage and freedom are relative issues, relative to a particular issue. Because Paul himself said, if you're a man's free man, if in the human setting you're a free man, you're God's bondservant. If you're man's bondservant, you're God's free man. So it's relative to the setting and to the issues that are involved. And so we ask the question, how were Hagar and Sarah really different in terms of being one being a bondwoman, one being a free woman? Because even Sarah wasn't. I mean, she was a wife. Under the law, or even under the historical reality, the wife is under a head, her husband. So in what sense is she free? And really, in what sense is Abraham free, since God's God? So, when you look at it that way, there are certain issues where Hagar's a free woman, but she's not free in relation to Sarah and Abraham's dominion over her. And Sarah is a bondwoman in some regards, but in this case, she's a free woman. So we just raised the issue of what's the issue of the freedom and the bondage, and I argued that because of chapter 5, verse 1, where he says, it was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and don't be subject again to the yoke of bondage or slavery. And he's talking about the law, verse 3. If you receive circumcision, you're under obligation to keep the whole law. So, because chapter 5 is the beginning of the last section of the book, and he wants to move from the theological reality of justification by faith into the way you live this out in real history, chapters 5 and 6 have to do with how justified believers are supposed to live out their justification. Since that's the case, chapter 5, verse 1 is kind of a summary of the last thing that he said. So, the illustration, the historical narrative is about bondage and freedom. But, because those are both relative terms, we ask, in which case, or what case, what is the focus that makes Hagar a bondwoman and Sarah a free woman? And I argued last time that the issue of the text is the sons. Abraham had two sons. Verse 23, the son by the bondwoman was born this way. The son by the free woman was born that way. It's about the sons. So, the issue of bondage and freedom has to do with this issue of bearing Abraham a son. And in that setting, Hagar had no choices. She was Sarah's handmaid. It was Sarah's plan that Hagar be Abraham's concubine or whatever. The plan was that Abraham and Hagar would have their sexual relationship, and maybe Hagar would become pregnant, and maybe she'd have a boy child, and that'd be a son. I mean, this is all up in the air. As far as we know, we don't know if Hagar's fruitful or not. She doesn't have a husband. Apparently that's never been a tested reality. Even if she conceives, there's no guarantee it'll be a boy instead of a girl. But the plan is, Hagar will be the surrogate to bear the son that God promised Abraham. That's Sarah's plan. Hagar may not have had any problem with that. She may have been enamored with Abraham. She may have been making eyes at him. Who knows? I don't think that Sarah would have set this up if she'd have thought her handmaid had any designs on her husband. But nonetheless, we don't know anything about Hagar's attitude about being under this requirement. But we know that she had no choice. She was going to be Abraham's concubine, like it or not. That made her a bondwoman. She had no freedom. So the fact that she did conceive and did have a son played into the thing. I mean, that's what Sarah wanted to happen, and it played out that way. But the fact is, Hagar was a bondwoman, and in the historical analogy, being bound is not a good thing. That's what chapter 5, verse 1 is. Be free. Don't be subject to the yoke of bondage. Bondage is not a good thing. But in this case, it's the bondage of the issue of whether God's promise is going to be fulfilled and how. It hasn't been fulfilled with Abraham and Sarah yet. Abraham's, what, 86 years old? Something like that? 85? I think Ishmael was born when he was 86. So, time's running out in terms of age. Sarah comes up with a plan. Hagar is subject to it. On the other hand, Sarah is free. And she's free for several reasons. One is, she's under no mandate from anybody to bear a son. God did promise Abraham and Sarah that they'd have a son. But promise is not a mandate. Mandate's a command. You do this. She's under no mandate. She doesn't have to bear a son. It's not her responsibility to bear a son. She's free. She has no mandate over her. Secondly, she's free because even if she never bears the son, there'll be no consequences upon her from Abraham for her failure. Abraham will say, well, she's barren. There's nothing we can do about that. I'm not going to kick her out of the house and make her not my wife anymore because she can't bear me a child. There are no consequences here for her failure. If there are no consequences for failure, you're free. That's the bottom line. No consequences for failure, you're free. You don't have to perform. You don't have any mandate to perform. Even if you had a mandate and couldn't fulfill it, you're still free because there are no consequences. That's the whole point. That's the issue of justification by promise through faith, because if you're justified by grace through faith, there are no consequences for failure after the fact. Whatever you do, you're out from under the law. Justice is not going to address you, period, ever. So that's the background and that's the focus. This evening what we're going to do is we're going to go on into verse 23 and look at Paul's description of the sons. The son by the bondwoman, he says, was born according to the flesh, whatever that means. And the son born by the free woman was born through promise, whatever that means. So that's what we're going to be talking about this evening, is what that means. It's clear from the text that he changes his grammar in the text because he uses the according to the standard of flesh. Kata plus the accusative is according to standard. The standard is flesh. The son of the bondwoman was born according to the standard. The standard is flesh. He doesn't say the son of the free woman was born according to the standard of promise. He just says the son of the free woman was born through promise. So we need to understand this whole flesh issue because it's one of the biggest issues in Paul's theology. It's flesh. If you look up the word flesh and the way it's used, in Paul's letters, there are two letters where the majority of his references to flesh show up. One of them is in Romans and the other is Galatians. The references in Romans are more than they are in Galatians. I think he uses the word flesh in Galatians 16 times and he uses the word flesh in Romans 23 times. But when you look at the relative length of the two letters, Galatians is 6 chapters long and Romans is 16 chapters long. So in the 16 chapters of Romans, you have 23 uses of this word, but in the 6 chapters of Galatians, it's 16 times. So obviously, in Galatians, flesh is a big deal. That's just based on word usage. Shows up often, very often. And that automatically means that it's a major issue. So, given the fact that Galatians is the most heavily populated portion of Paul's writings that have to do with flesh, we want to understand, what does he mean? What is the standard called flesh that produced the son Ishmael and didn't produce the son Isaac? In the book of Galatians, in the 16 times that it's used, flesh is almost always a negative context. It's a context with negative overtones. The biggest one is chapter 5, where the flesh lusts against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. The two are contrary, one to the other. It's a big, big contrast, heavy-duty conflict kind of setting. So you get the impression that flesh is not a good thing. And in this paragraph, the son that's born according to the standard of flesh is ostracized from the family at the end of the text. What does the scripture say? Verse 30. Throw out! Along with the son of the bondwoman will not be the heir with the son of the free woman. That's not going to happen. Get rid of her. So it's a very bad thing to have a son according to flesh, according to that standard. So flesh is a problematic issue, and it's a big thing, and like I said, in Paul's writings. If things are fleshly, that's not good. So what we want to understand is this standard thing, according to the standard called flesh. And it's a bad deal because it says in verse 29, he who is born according to the standard of flesh persecuted him who was born according to the spirit. according to the standard of the Spirit, which is by promise or through promise. But the point is, if you're fleshly, you will persecute what is spiritual. It's automatic. He said, that's the way it is. If your origins are fleshly, you will automatically persecute the legitimate realities. So you'll be opposed to truth. You won't like people that stand for truth. It's automatic. It's just the way it works. That's what happened there, and that's the way the standards work. So flesh is an issue we need to understand. In chapter 4, verse 23, there's a strong contrast established when it comes to being able to grasp the message of the law. Verse 21, are you hearing the message? Okay, how am I supposed to hear it? Well, you're going to hear it in the historical narrative regarding the birth of Ishmael and Isaac. The message is going to show up here. Obviously, then, that means that the message of the law is going to show up in terms of the distinction in this context between flesh and promise, or flesh and spirit, as it showed up a little bit later. But in this verse, it's flesh and promise, according to the standard flesh, through promise. The issues that are involved in this matter of understanding the standard are several. I'd like for us to start with the fact that Abraham and Hagar, the bondwoman, produced a son the way all sons are produced. The mechanics of the birth of Ishmael, typical. Nothing unusual. This is just the way sons are produced. All human births are produced the way Hagar and Abraham produced the son. This is just the way it is. But the fact is that Abraham and Sarah produced a son by exactly the same methodology. Abraham and Sarah didn't do any kind of magic stuff. They just engaged in the sexual behavior that they had always engaged in. The difference this time that produces the son, that's according to this text, is promise. In Hebrews 11, is very point blank about the fact that Sarah received the strength to conceive seed by faith. And that means that Sarah's barrenness was an abnormality. It wasn't unusual necessarily, but it was an abnormality. She couldn't have children for whatever reason. We don't know if it was a vitamin deficiency. We don't know. But the fact is, her eggs were never fertilized. She never could conceive. Hadn't been able to all of her married life. Now she's 90 years old. She's way past the change of life. There's no way. But Abraham and Sarah's behavior was exactly the same as Abraham and Hagar's behavior. The difference was, in this setting of behavior, Sarah had had an attitude change. She had heard God say to Abraham, when the year comes around, your wife will conceive and she'll bear a son. And Sarah laughed. And when she laughed, the Lord asked Abraham, why is your wife laughing? Oh, I didn't laugh. Yes, you did. And then the question, that question that always comes, is anything too hard for God? Is anything impossible with Yahweh? And, of course, that's the standard challenge. You think he can't keep his word just because you're 90 years old? You think there are any extenuating circumstances that will keep God from keeping his word? Any. Why are you laughing? You think this is a joke? Well, yeah, I did, but not anymore. I mean, when you get confronted like that, you have to then decide, how am I going to answer this? Am I going to continue to depend on the barrenness that's been my standard all my life and has been the cause of my frustration for the vast majority of my married life, and I've never been able to bear my husband the son he always wanted, It's been a burden on me. It's been a burden on him. I've never been able to do it. I can't do it now. It ain't going to happen. Are you going to stay with that, or are you going to answer the question? God said, within a year, is there anything for him that's too difficult? If you say, no, he can keep his word, then you're forced to say, well, what did he say? He said, I'm going to get pregnant. She believed him. That was the thing that changed. Therefore, we cannot say that according to the standard of flesh means engaging in a certain kind of mechanical behavior. That's not what fleshly means. When we ask the question about what does it mean according to the standard of flesh, the answer cannot be, well, it's a certain kind of behavior. This is what it means to be fleshly, to do this kind of behavior. Because that's not true. Abraham and Hagar's behavior was fleshly, but not because it was a certain kind of behavior. It was because it was an illicit kind of behavior. So it's not about the kind of behavior. It's about what's driving it and the setting it's operating in. Sarah does not conceive Isaac because they did something different. She conceives because her attitude toward God and his promise has changed. She believes him now. So that's what Hebrews 11 says, that she received the capacity to conceive when she believed. So, since the action that's taken is the same in both cases, we have to look for that something else that reveals what constitutes fleshliness and what doesn't. And when we look in the narrative, we find there are several things involved before the action takes place. Before Abraham and Hagar do anything, there are some things that have come into play. One of the things that I think is fairly significant is that I don't think it's an accident that Abraham's behavior was exactly like the behavior of Adam in his fleshliness. And what I mean by that is, how did Adam get drawn into introducing sin into the human race? What were the mechanics that were at work there that we see Abraham doing exactly the same thing? And the answer is, he listened to his wife's plan. Adam was drawn into sin because his wife sinned and offered him the opportunity to copy her example. In other words, Adam, I have done this, and now I'm giving you the opportunity to follow my example. Well, that introduced all of the disaster that has happened since Genesis 3. And it's not Eve's fault. Yes, she was the instigator, but the responsible person is the guy who did it. It's the personal responsibility as the head of the human race. He can blame his wife if he wants to. God's not going to accept that. She can blame the snake if she wants to. God's not going to accept that. The fact is, the person who does it is the one who's responsible for doing it. It doesn't matter what the circumstances were that were prodding and poking and pushing to get you to do that. If you ever acknowledge or allow Satan made me do it. If you buy that, you're just shoving your responsibility off. And if you're going to do that, you're never going to relate to God. He doesn't accept that. You have to come to God and say, I did it. Confession's good for the relationship. If you confess, he forgives. If you say, well, it's somebody else's fault, there's no forgiveness there because there's no confession there. Not my fault. I didn't. I did, but it was really not my fault. Well, as long as it's not your fault, you can't confess it. You can't be forgiven it. The relationship's strangled, and there's nothing that can be done because you won't accept responsibility. it's no accident that the plan to have Hagar become Abraham's concubine was Sarah's plan. She was the instigator of a bad deal. And her husband had the responsibility of saying, wife, that's not a good idea. In that respect, I see an exact mirror between Adam and Eve and Abraham and Sarah. The wife is being, she has been prodded to try to become the head over her head. And she's yielded to that, and she's trying to do it. And the head that's her over her lets her become the head over him. And when he does that, disaster. Well, it's the whole human race when it was Adam, but everything that exists in our world today between Islam and the rest of the world is the direct outcome of the birth of Ishmael. It's a direct outcome of Abraham's yielding to his wife's plan. I think that because Paul was standardizing this issue of flesh and spirit, in particularly in verse 29 of chapter 4, where he talks about the one born according to the flesh persecutes the one who's born according to the spirit, so it is also now. He's saying this is the standard operating procedure. Because Paul did standardize that, and he calls the one flesh and the other through promise or spirit, I think what he's doing is he's just running history by us. You can go all the way back to Cain and Abel, and you'll find the one born according to flesh persecuting the one born according to promise. Cain kills Abel. Cain is the firstborn. Eve thinks that he's the Messiah. She names him Striker, Cain, because he's supposed to strike the head of the serpent. That's what God said would happen when she, it would be her seed that did it. So she thinks the first seed's the fulfillment. So she names him that. She treats him that way. The next boy that's born is insignificant. She names him insignificant. That's what Abel means. Able to do nothing significant. Play on English words. But the fact is, she raised those boys in a household where one could do no wrong and the other could do no right. Well, that's a mix for disaster. And that's what happened. The disaster fell because Abel offered a legitimate sacrifice that made Cain so mad that God wouldn't accept his that he killed him. And so he that was born and raised according to the standard of flesh persecutes the one who's not fleshly. That's the beginning, Cain and Abel. And he says that's the way it was with Ishmael and Isaac. And he says that's the reason why these persecutors of you in Galatia are doing what they're doing. So it is now. That's what verse 29 says. This is across the board, throughout history. Flesh will always oppose spirit. Promise. That's the way it works. So, we have to see Paul's argument as a large umbrella, where the real issue is men faltering in the face of difficulties because they let their wives guide them into the proper understanding of the will of God. That's foolishness. Paul says to Timothy, Eve was deceived, Adam was not. God made the husband to be the head and the spiritual leader, and he does not desire that the head should submit himself to his wife's understanding, because the possibilities are she won't understand properly, and he will be, if he submits to that false understanding, he will sin. That's the way it works. So, Adam and Eve, Abraham and Sarah, this is the way. When we talk about fleshly, we're starting with this issue of male irresponsibility. Not accepting the responsibility. It's an attitude thing. Where the man refuses to be faithful to what he knows is God's will. I believe that Abraham had to know that it was not God's will for him to have a son through Hagar. He had to know that for multiple reasons, but the fact is, there is no man and wife relationship on the planet, and never has been in history, where a man could love his wife and take another woman to his bed. Never happened in history. Never. The man has to love his wife and keep himself to her, or he just loves himself and enjoys the sexual woo. So, especially if she's willing for it to happen, well, then fine. So you have men who multiply wives to themselves, and God calls it only evil continually. You have the example of Jacob, who works for 7 years to get the woman he loves, and he gets his daddy-in-law slips a sister in on him. So the next morning when they can see each other, he thinks, oh, man. And so he works another 7 years to get the woman he loves. But he never did love Leah. Never. It didn't matter what she did, he didn't love her. She gave him 3 sons in a row, and he still didn't love her. You can't, a man can't love his wife and take another woman to his bed. It just doesn't work that way. You've got to sacrifice your love in order to be able to do that. And Abraham had to know that. There's no way he could have not known that. But he was frustrated by the lack of fulfillment of the promise. And his wife was frustrated, and she was kind of a harridan. The word Sarai means bitter. She's a, you know, she is a frustrated woman and has been for years and years and years. And, you know, Solomon knew what he was saying when he said, it might be better to live up there on the roof than to have to put up with all this. Well, Abraham and Sarah loved each other, but she was kind of, because she was frustrated. Well, he was frustrated too. And after years of this, it gets to be kind of easy to say, well, maybe you're right. Maybe it is God's plan for us to have a son by some other woman than you. Maybe you're right. Well, all right, we'll try it. Bad decision. Fleshly. The issue here is not where Abraham got the idea. He got it from his wife. No, that's not the issue. The issue is that the plans flew in the face of truth at the most fundamental levels of love and faith. There was no love there. There was no faith there. That's where it failed. And by the way, everything biblical eventually come back around to love, faith. Those are the two drivers. Love is the greatest of all because it sets the agenda, but faith is the methodology because that's how you pursue the agenda. Everything in life ultimately comes back to what's important and how are you going to chase it. You can't get away from that. And Abraham failed at the love and faith level. And that's what constituted the fleshliness of it. It wasn't the action. It was the attitude. The attitude at the level of love and the attitude at the level of faith. He failed on both counts. You'll never find an example in the Bible of a man who operates by a legitimate love and a legitimate faith and introduces the kind of chaos that's introduced by fleshliness. It is only fleshliness that produces this kind of conflict. So, I said it's not possible for a man to love his wife and take another woman to his bed. It's not possible for a man to believe God and take another woman to his bed. It's not possible. If you believe God, you say, God made a promise. I've been waiting for 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. It hasn't happened yet. I'm still waiting, but I'm not dead yet. After I'm
dead.
Yeah, right. As far as the physical ability is concerned, he's physically almost dead. Well, in fact, Paul said he was dead at that ability level. But the fact is, you run into this. Zacharias and Elizabeth, the Bible says that they were both godly people and they walked according to the law of Moses. But the Bible says that if you walk according to the law of Moses, you won't be barren. Your wife won't be barren. Well, Elizabeth's barren. God lied. No, he did not lie. Not until Elizabeth dies childless. Then God lied. She didn't die childless. It doesn't happen that way. When God says something, he means it. It's true. And a man of faith will say, well, God made this promise. It hadn't happened yet. It looks like it's never going to happen, but I'm not dead yet. Therefore, I'm going to keep trusting that God's going to do what he said he'd do. I know that's hard. We're not talking about it being easy. We're just talking about whether it's fleshly or not. The issue is, it was fleshly. The issue of fleshliness is the issue of the submission of love to false objectives and the submission of faith to lies. That's what makes fleshliness fleshliness. It's the attitudes at the love and faith level. That's how Paul defines fleshliness. It's not about bodies doing things. It's about attitudes that then provide the motivation for the bodies to do what they do. Is it fleshly for a man to commit adultery? Well, sure it is. But it's not fleshly because, well, it is fleshly because the action is itself wrong. The physical action is itself wrong. But that physical action would have never taken place if there hadn't been a flaw at the love-faith levels. So the real problem with fleshliness is not what's done, it's why it's done, what's driving it. That's Paul's definition. When he says the one by the bondwoman was born according to the standard of flesh, he's telling us, there were some horrible failures at the love-faith levels here, and that's what produced Ishmael. It also produced bondage for everybody that follows that methodology. You set up a false system of values, you set up a false system of truth, and bondage is automatic. By the same token, if you love the right things and you believe the right things, you're as free as you can be. And you know it in your head and heart and everywhere else. You know you're free because the love is there, the faith is there, you're free. And it really doesn't matter if you're an abject slave. If the love's there and the faith's there, you're free. Because freedom is the issue. Bondage is the issue. It's fleshliness. So, the biblical narrative tells us that Abraham was frustrated with God over the lack of a son. That's Genesis 15. God, what kind of reward are you going to be since Eliezer of Damascus is the only heir I got? I don't got no heir. I don't have a son. You promised me a son. I don't have a son. Genesis 15:2. In four verses, Abraham's justified because in those four verses, he comes to verse 6. Abraham believed God, was declared to him for righteousness. But Ishmael's born after Genesis 15. So we know that Abraham was subject to the frustration of being stalled off, or, you know, God saying, not yet, it's not my time, not yet. Abraham's tired of hearing that. Not in words, but in fact. Every month goes by, his wife ends up not being pregnant. He's in effect being told by God, the time's not right yet, not yet. And Abraham said, I'm tired of hearing that. I don't have an heir. Who are you going to give? What kind of reward can you give me? I only one thing I want, a boy. And all I got is Eliezer. He's not my son. So, Abraham's frustrated. He's frustrated over the issue of the promise. And being frustrated with God over the question of God's integrity is a very dangerous place to be. If you don't take that frustration to God himself. The Psalms are full of David being frustrated with the way things are. And he'll rail at God early in a psalm. But before the psalm's finished, he's back in harmony again, because somehow or another, his interaction with God over his frustration with God has been resolved, and now he's not frustrated anymore. That's the way the Psalms work. So it's not bad to be frustrated with God. What's bad is when you don't take that frustration to God and work it out until you're satisfied again. Well, Abraham is in very dangerous territory. He's frustrated with God. His wife comes along with a suggestion. The problem here is, if you're frustrated with God over a question of his integrity, he made a promise, he hadn't fulfilled it, you're frustrated because he hadn't fulfilled it yet. The key word there is yet. You're in a dangerous position if you don't handle that before God, but being so committed to a desire, even when it's a desire that God has already said is okay, when you're so committed to a desire that you cannot yield that desire to the obvious will of God, that's even more dangerous than being frustrated with God. God had promised Abraham a son. Abraham wanted a son so bad he could taste it. But there's something wrong with wanting a son so bad that you're not willing to yield to the obvious will of God day by day, month by month. I mean, it's perfectly fine to long for a son. You have a promise from God for a son, but it's obvious as the months go by that the promise timing is not yet, and you're getting so frustrated because your desire is for the son, as if that was the be-all, end-all of life. And it's never the case that a desire for anything less than the presence of God is the be-all, end-all, because it is the presence of God that is the be-all, end-all. And it doesn't matter what else you want. You will not have the quality of life by getting your other desires fulfilled that you will have if you are in the presence of God over the whole issue. So whenever your desires, even if they're in harmony with God's promise, even if the desire is in harmony with the promise of God, if that desire is more important to you than God himself is, then you're in even more dangerous territory than being frustrated with him. Because now you've got a different God. You want something more than you want his will. That's where Abraham was really... I mean, this is the whole struggle of men who are sinners being brought to maturity of faith. It took Abraham forever to get to the point where he was able to say, look, God made the promise, up to him to keep it. That's where I'm going to camp. It took him most of his first 100 years of living to come to that point. But he had to come there. He had to. Now, he got 75 more years to enjoy having arrived at that conclusion and the benefit of that conclusion. So he had 75. He almost had a whole another lifetime to enjoy having come to faith in a real profound sense. But the fact is, it took him almost 100 years to get there. So the issue of the narrative then is Abraham's frustrated. He's overcommitted to wanting a son, and Sarah couched her plan in terms of the will of God. Take my handmaid, and perhaps God will give you the son. See, it's all God talk. Very pious. Deceptive. In Genesis 16:1, she suggests that it's the will of God for Abraham to take Hagar. By the time verse 5 rolls around, she says, my wrong be on your head. Which is where it was, because he was the head. But after Hagar conceived, she started treating Sarah snotty. Because I'm pregnant and you never were able to, I'm superior to you. You know, you can't take that from a slave. And she said, my wrong be on your head, which means I was wrong. This plan was not a good idea. I was wrong. Well, that means then the plan never was right. Even the God talk about this might be God's will and plan, whatever. Now, that's just words to get your plan in place, because you're letting frustration and stuff drive instead of the love and faith issues. So this is the narrative. This is what tells us what fleshliness is. And that means then we can deduct this regarding Paul's concept of flesh. Fleshliness will always have its roots in false objectives, that is, loves that are illegitimate, and in deception regarding truth. Something will be put forward as truth that's not true. Fleshliness will always have those twin roots, false objectives and lies. That's fleshliness. So the roots are there, and the goals of fleshliness have to do with obtaining an end that cannot be supported by love and faith. The love and truth of God will never be able to support the objectives of fleshliness. Fleshliness always has an objective that cannot be supported by legitimate love and truth. Can't happen. Even in Galatians, the legalists are putting it out that their real objective is your spiritual lives. But it's a lie. Their real objective is my exaltation over you. That's the real objective. But it's cast under all this religious lie, deception. So that's his concept. The roots of fleshliness are always going to be false objectives and lies. And the goals have to do with obtaining an end that cannot be supported by love and truth. And it boils down to a most basic attitude. Fleshliness is human beings involved in the intention to take God's place in a contentious setting. I cannot trust God. I will not trust God. This setting is upsetting me, and I'm fed up with it, and I'm going to do something about it. And that means I'm going to take God's place in this situation and become the God who decides what will happen. That's the bottom line of fleshliness. Invariably, it's a human being trying to take over God's job. And that's the counter to promise. Because what is promise? God saying what his job is and what he's going to do. That's promise. God says, I promise this is going to happen. That means I'm going to do it because it's my will that's being done. I'm promising you that it'll be done. I want you to believe that I'm going to do it because this is my will. I am the God here. And faith says, you get to be the God here. You set the agenda. You set the truth. I'll just follow it. So promise terminology assumes a human interest. You don't make promises about things that people don't want. It assumes this human interest. Abraham, you're going to have a son. Great, that's what I've always wanted. That's fine. Promise addresses an assumed human interest. But promise assumes a divine commitment that cannot be violated, regardless of any other considerations other than faith. The only thing that will keep promise from being fulfilled is unbelief. As long as Sarah didn't believe, she couldn't conceive. If she didn't come to faith, she was never going to conceive. If she didn't come to faith when she was 90, then maybe she'll have to come to faith when she's 100 or 110. But she's not going to conceive until she believes the promise. That's the only thing that promise requires, is that you believe him. Once you believe him, hey, integrity is at stake. God's. He made the promise. He's got to keep it. You trust him to keep his word. He's got to keep it or he's a liar. So you put God on the spot, really, when you believe what he says, because from then on, he's got to do it. It's not like he didn't want to, but even if he didn't want to, he'd still have to do it if he's going to maintain his integrity. Once a promise is believed, the whole deal's over, except for the outworking of the details. The problem with promise, typically, is one thing, and that's the timing. If God made promises today and he fulfilled them tomorrow, nobody'd have a problem with it. But typically, when God makes promises, He doesn't give a timing. That was Eve's first fault. She thought that your son will bruise his head meant the first son she ever bore. Well, she was only 4,000 years off. But that was the problem. If God would do what He said He was going to do immediately, then there wouldn't be any problem. But even the promise of the second coming is scoffed at in the New Testament. Peter says, they'll scoff at this because there's going to be enough time to go by, then they're going to say, yeah, that promise has been around forever. It hadn't been fulfilled. It's not going to be. And Peter said, don't buy that. Timing has always been a big deal. But God's on a timetable. When the fullness of the time comes, He does what He said He'd do. So, Paul's point is, he clearly wants the Galatians to give up their attempts to control God. That's what legalism's all about. Trying to control God. And he wants the Galatians to see that letting God be God is the root of freedom. You're never more free than when God's God in your head and you're glad. Let Him be God and you'll be free. That's all I planned to say.